following is a presentation of Emmanuel Covenant Church, located in South Surrey, British Columbia. To learn more, please visit us online at emmanuelcovenant.ca.
In June of 1975, I joined with my seminary classmates at a dinner given to us as we prepared to graduate and go out into the world and become ministers. After the dinner, the dean stood up and he spoke, and part of his talk went like this. He says, "Fellas," and in those days it was mostly fellas, he says, "Fellas, you are equipped to serve in any covenant church that we may have. But the reality is the 80-20 rule. That is, 80% of the churches you will serve, you will do well in. You'll have a good time and you'll feel very good. In 10% of the churches, you'll do very well. You will have deep relationships, people will love you, and it will be difficult when you leave. And in 10% of the churches, you will not be liked or appreciated. There will be conflict and tension, and likely you will leave, perhaps embittered, mostly unhappy." I wasn't sure if this was good news or bad news, but I went, 9 out of 10, that's, yeah, I can live with that. In June of 597 BC, Ezekiel found himself in a similar situation. He was 25 years old. He'd finished his training, or almost, I guess, in becoming a priest. His father was a priest in the temple in Jerusalem. Now, that position was a plum position. He had gotten all the best education in the law, in theology, and in fact, he had learned almost surgical skills at learning how to make animals ready for sacrifice. So he was very good with a knife. He was about to enter into a job for which he would have power and prestige, and he probably wouldn't lack financially. 10%. He was in that 10% that we all want. But then the Babylonians came, led by King Nebuchadnezzar. They surrounded the city of Jerusalem, and within 3 months, the king had to resign and give up. And Nebuchadnezzar's armies marched into Jerusalem. They sacked the temple, but they left it standing. They left the wall standing. But they then took about 10,000 of the population that comprised the people who were the artisans, the priests, among whom Ezekiel would have been part of it, and I assume his father would have gone too. People who had the education and the ability to foment revolution were taken away, and they marched some 900 kilometers to Babylonia. And if you're kind of thinking, think of a clock, think of 5 after 8. The small hands on the 8, that's Jerusalem. The large hands on the 1, that's Babylon. They went up. They walked the whole distance. And they were resituated in a community that had been built on before. And that's where they were told, "This is your new home." They were located along the canal that fed their agriculture, and it was called the river Kibar. Now, fast forward 5 years to July of 592 BC, and it so happens that it's as I'm told, I don't know this, right, but this is what commentators say, it was his birth date. He mentions a certain day and so on. He was 30 years old. Interestingly enough, you couldn't begin to serve in the temple until you were 30 years old. That was like the year of maturity for a man. Think about this for a second. Here's this guy who has been trained, he's excited, he's been waiting for his 30th birthday so that he could finally do what he's been training to do. And where does he find himself? Well, I'll just turn back to chapter 1. And it says, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Kibar River, he was sitting on the banks, or however it was. And what I imagine is he was devastated. It's his birthday. And rather than stepping into his career, he was sitting as an exile in a foreign land. Now, if that's not enough to depress you, he's sitting there and he looks, and we're told in chapter 1 now, by the way, I'm going to paraphrase this, but he looks and he sees this dark cloud coming. And then at first he's not sure what it is, but it's moving towards him. And as it gets closer, he sees like lightning and dark thunder. And as a person who had studied the Old Testament, he would know that when Yahweh came, he often appeared in earthquakes or in thunderclouds, the power. And as it gets closer and closer and the lights are flashing, he suddenly realizes Yahweh is here. He's in this cloud. He's making an appearance. He falls, he realized that this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. He fell face down and he heard the voice of one speaking. And God said, "Son of man, I'm sending you to the Israelites, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me, they and their fathers. The people to whom I'm sending you are obstinate and stubborn. Say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. And whether they listen or fail to listen, for they are a rebellious house, they will know that a prophet has been among them." So the ministry of Ezekiel begins. Not as a priest serving in the temple in Jerusalem, but as a prophet to the exiles in Babylonia. It covers 21 years in Ezekiel's life, and perhaps the most important date, remember we're in 592 now, would be 5 years later in 587 and 586, because back in Jerusalem, they had thought, let's try once more to revolt. And so they tried, and Nebuchadnezzar said, okay, that's it. And with his armies, he came in, he levels the city. And the remainder of the people there are sent into exile as well. The nation was left in smoke and ruins. Israel was no longer. Ezekiel's first 20-some chapters are judgments on Israel. They were intended to bring the exiled people to a place of repentance for their sinfulness. What we sometimes think about Ezekiel is that oftentimes he acted out his messages in somewhat bizarre ways. Ezekiel wasn't a conventional prophet or preacher, but he was there to get his point across. Then in chapters 37, Ezekiel changes his message to one of hope. And here is where we are for the month of August. Verse 1 begins with, "The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley." Ezekiel was a person who seemed to have visions, hard to exactly say, but he had unusual psychological experiences. And that phrase, "the hand of the Lord is upon me," was the same phrase that's used in chapter 1 when God calls him to be the prophet. And these visions that he has when the hand of the Lord is upon him is like a signal to us that he's having what Marcia would call a flying dream. He's like picked up and transported. But what kind of a vision is he having? It seems as though Ezekiel was transported with no understanding of where he was, except that he found himself in the middle of a plain, although they call it a valley, that is literally covered with bones. Now, interestingly enough, a priest was forbidden and was strictly, you know, don't touch a corpse. Have nothing to do with that because you'll render yourself impure. And yet, the Lord himself led Ezekiel back and forth among the bones. Can you imagine that? Two figures walking, looking, kind of trying to understand, what is this? And it's the Lord himself, and I find this so interesting. I thought it was the Lord's law, and yet he seems to have the power to break it. Now, an interesting detail about this picture is the dryness of the bones. I'm going to ask you a question just right off the top of your heads. It says, they look and they see that these bones are white, like they're bleached. And why would they be that? Why would they be bleached? Exactly. And where had they been? Out in the sun. Now, that doesn't mean too much to us, except imagine your loved one, their bones were lying on the top of the ground. What would you think? You'd go, what happened? That's desecrating. And to Middle Eastern people, improper burial was the highest insult that you could give. What these bones suggest right off the bat is that this valley is full of bones that have never been buried. As if the person who, or the army that conquered them, to add insult to injury, just left them. Just a way of saying, that's how little we think about you. Follows them even beyond death. Then God asks a very interesting question, kind of a philosophical, theological question. Son of man, can these bones live? Wow. He's looking at bleached bones that, you know, if they're bleached, that means that they're leached, there's nothing there. And Ezekiel, and remember, this is a vision now, he's looking and going, whoa, what am I supposed to say here? But he thinks on his feet, and he realizes that even though in his Bible there's no plan of resurrection, they know about Elijah and Elisha who have brought back one or two people from the dead, but would call resuscitation, they had no hope for a resurrection this size. But we're dealing with Yahweh, the God of creation. And so Ezekiel, the son of man, replies, O sovereign Lord, only you know. Meaning, you can do it, but I don't know. Now, so far, Ezekiel doesn't know where these bones are from. But what we'll find out in verse 11 is that these bones represent the nation of Israel. And remember, this is the vision. And what God is really asking is, do you think that the nation of Israel can be brought back from the death of the exile and the destruction of Jerusalem? Is there hope for this people? Then Ezekiel gets an order that could only happen in a dream. Prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Christopher Wright comments on this passage and he says, preach, insisted the divine voice, preach to the dead. Preach the promise of breath and life, of flesh and skin, and of the knowledge of Yahweh, the Lord and giver of life. So Ezekiel prophesied as he was commanded. And as he prophesied, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them. But there was no breath in them. Commentators suggest that Ezekiel's training in animal sacrifice seems to be evident here, as he notes how the tendons bind the bones together and flesh covers everything, only it's going in reverse direction from what he was taught. But there was no life in them. They were essentially corpses. Then the divine voice speaks and says, prophesy to the breath and breathe into the slain that they may live. Again, Christopher Wright notes that this scene is dominated by the Hebrew word ruach. It's the word that means spirit or breath. And in these 14 verses, that word occurs 10 times. The Spirit of God, the wind that comes from the four corners, I'll breathe my spirit into you. Now, once is okay. Twice we are pay attention, but 10 times it's like there's flashing lights. Pay attention. This breath had lifted Ezekiel up and carried him to the plain. This breath is a spirit of the living God. It is the breath that is breathed into the corpses, and they miraculously come to life. And the sum total of all this activity is life. Life out of utter deadness. Again, commentators note that in this vision that Ezekiel has, they denote a two-stage process. Now, this is worth coming for this morning, okay? I've learned a lot from doing this preparation. I got to tell you, I love this, okay? Can you think of any place in the Bible that has to do with breathing life and there's a two-stage process? Yeah, exactly. The creation of man. Now you see, this humbles me because you guys already know this. Genesis 2:7, and God formed man from the dust of the ground, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. First, the bones come together, the tendons, the flesh, and then the breath comes into them, and they stand up. They're living. This is nothing short of the recreation of humanity. And you know what? You don't find this anywhere else in the Old Testament. This is Ezekiel's vision that he sees for this nation. Maybe I should say it's God's vision for these dry bones. A miracle of new existence, the revival of Israel, will be nothing less than the recreation of humanity as we know it from the book of Genesis. Now, commentators think that beginning with verse 11, the vision ends, and Ezekiel is kind of brought back to earth, wherever that is, whether it's by the riverbank of Kibar or in his own house. And now, Ezekiel is given the explanation for the vision. Verse 11 begins, "Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they," meaning the exiles, "they say, our bones are dried up and our hope is lost. We are indeed cut off." Now, interestingly enough, that appears to be almost like a cliche or kind of a phrase that the exiles have created for themselves. So, for example, you might come up to me and say, "How's it going?" I'm saying, "Ah, it's terrible." And all you have to do is go, "Oh, okay." That says it all. These three phrases, interestingly enough, they're a lament, and the three different kinds are, they come out of the book of Psalms and also the book of Isaiah. You know that last phrase, cut off? In Isaiah 53, talking about the suffering servant, it says he'll make his death in Sheol. He's cut off from the land of the living. Very interesting, the connections that are here. So what God is saying is, he said, "I've heard your people saying, look, our bones are dried up." That's where these bone images are coming from. "Our hope is lost. We are indeed cut off." Christopher Wright notes that once Jerusalem had been destroyed in 586, the Jews realized that they would not be returning soon, if ever, to Jerusalem. Exile in the pagan enemy land of Babylon was a living death. And they summed up their feelings in the lament of verse 11. "Our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off." We are the living dead. This isn't life. We're going through the motions down here. Notice that in verse 12, the scene changes. Now, I'm going to give you my own idea here. Christopher Wright wouldn't necessarily agree with me here, but, you know, we're nearly finished, so I can launch out myself. He says, God says, "I'm going to open up the graves and bring you forth and bring you back to Israel." Now, when I said before that to be not buried was an insult, in verse 12, they have a proper burial. So God is going to open the graves. My thinking is this: the shame which would have been attached to the first scene of the Valley of the Bones is now replaced. The shame has been removed. They have been properly buried, but God intends to open their graves and to take them back to their homeland. The resurrection of the nation is going to happen. New life is being breathed into lifeless bodies. "You shall live, and I will place you in your own land." Now, there's one more date to remember: 532 BC. It's about 50 years or 60 after Ezekiel has prophesied this. there's a new king, a new sheriff in town. His name is Cyrus. And what does Cyrus say? I want to give everybody permission to go back to their home countries. In fact, I'm going to write a letter so that you can take these to the chief forester or whoever is in charge, and I'm saying, give these people what they need to rebuild their city. Whoa. Amen? Unbelievable. Ezekiel 37 is a message of hope to people living in exile. Their God has not abandoned them, nor is he unable to rescue them from death and destruction. The vision of Ezekiel portrays Yahweh as the creator of Genesis 1 and 2, breathing life into a dead nation and recreating it. Now, this passage has several great questions that might get preached on. For example, can these bones live? We might find ourselves in serious loss, whether of a job or a partner or whatever. And we ask ourselves, can these bones live again? Is there hope in a hopeless situation? Are we able to find new life? Verse 11, and if you're like me, a bit on the depressed side, you like it melancholy, the lament of the exiles would be a powerful sermon in its own right. Our bones are dried up and our hope is lost. We are indeed cut off. This week I had a woman come into my office at work, another staff person, and kind of out of the blue, she lamented to me her life. And she spared no feelings. And in the middle of it, she said, I want no talk about God. I don't believe in God. And I found myself simply sitting there. And then she apologized to me. They always, either swearing they apologize to you, and I go, you don't have to apologize to me. God actually, he hears it. You're very sad. You have a right to be angry. The lament might be a good place for us to go from time to time. Or perhaps verse 13 might be good for the Sunday after Easter. You will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and raise you from your graves, O my people, and I will put my spirit within you, and you shall live. But these are possibilities for your next guest preachers. Ezekiel's vision does not seem to go beyond his ministry. He's not quoted in the New Testament. In fact, it doesn't really get picked up till the early church fathers, and they use this passage as a way to talk about resurrection. However, might this vision suggest to us the final hours of Jesus? Christopher Seitz, another commentator, writes that when Jesus is carrying his cross to Golgotha, he's going to a place called the place of the skull. The hill of execution has replaced a valley of dry bones. Both were places of death and shame. The final word that Nebuchadnezzar spoke in destroying Jerusalem appears to be the final word that crucifixion spoke to Jesus. Jesus entered just as fully as the nation of Israel did into death. White, bleached bones. In fact, if I had a little bit more time, I would go back and read you 1 Peter or 2 Peter where it says he descended into hell. He visited the prisoners. In other words, we're saying he fully experienced death, just in the same way that the nation of Israel had experienced it. But A trumpet blast 3 days later, complete with angels and linen grave clothes left behind, announced to the world that God chooses life over death. And that's what we celebrate today around the Lord's table. His sacrifice is not an ending, but it's the prelude to a glorious beginning. This passage is a message of hope for us today. Amen. God bless us.
This has been a presentation of Emmanuel Covenant Church, located in South Surrey, British Columbia. To learn more, please visit us online at emmanuelcovenant.ca.